Need some magic writing dust? That's not real. Start with this, a podcast featuring Night Vale creators Joseph Fink and me, Jeffrey Craner. Each episode we discuss a topic, then give you two assignments, something to consume and something to create. Start with this, playing games.
Art is hard, starting is hard. If you wanna start somewhere, you can start with this. You can start with this.
Playing games can be an essential and serious part of the creative process. Games give you rules, and rules give you a structure that you can build any number of sprawling edifices upon. These games can be with just yourself, the rules of which are only known to you, or the games can be with the audience, presenting them with the rules and allowing them to structure their experience of the work around the knowledge of those rules. Either way, serious, memorable art is created all the time by playing games. And also, you know what? Games are fun. I'm Jeffrey Craner, here with Joseph Fink. Let's go join this conversation.
So let's talk about playing games.
I like it.
What's a game? Artistically, what's a game? Because a game is related to structure,
mm-hmm.
Not all structures are games.
Right.
A game has a few things. It's a set of rules, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a set of rules that have some challenge to them. Like, you should be able to fail.
Right.
If you can't lose, it's probably not a game.
Yeah.
For instance, being like, I'm going to write a novel and it will have 13 chapters. I mean, you could fail at that, but it's not a game. Like, there's not a... You either do the thing or you don't, but there's not really a losing condition.
Yeah.
If you were like, I'm going to, for instance, the writer Ali Smith is currently writing 4 novels, each of which is about a different season.
Mm-hmm.
Themed around a season and each focused on what's happening right when... she's focusing on what's happening right now, mm-hmm. as she's writing in Britain. That's a game.
Right.
Those are a set of rules that have a challenge that she could fail at.
Right, because if I'm reading her series of 4 novels, each about the seasons, and I read autumn, and then I read winter, and then I read spring, and then the 4th one that comes out is just called I'm on a Boat. You know, like, it doesn't make any sense that, like, I know she's failed to hit that 4th mark, whereas somebody who says, my goal is to write 13 chapters, I don't know that I noticed that unless they call this book is 13 chapters.
But also, like, say she released Spring,
mm-hmm.
and it just didn't have anything to do with Spring, really? Like,
yeah.
It just didn't... You were like, okay, I get it. This is the 3rd book, so you've called it Spring, but at this point, this is just a name.
Right.
That, to me, is failing at the game.
Yeah.
Like, the game she set for herself is they're themed around these seasons.
Yeah. We can figure out if this fully relates to podcast making, but I think one of my favorite artistic games I've ever, seen in action was the... Obviously, we bring up the Neo-Futurists a ton on this show, but the Chicago Neo-Futurists, and I believe this play was written by Connor Callista, but... And I'm going to get a few of the details wrong about, like, the title, but I think it was called something like Take One for the Team, but they had a performer come out, and he was holding a super soaker water gun, and he walked up to a member of the audience, and he pumped up the gun, and he aimed it right at them, and he said, I'm going to unload this whole thing on you, unless you pick somebody else for me to do this too. And then the person sort of, like, panicked and looked around and then, like, pointed at their friend. And then he went to the next person and... did the same line to them, and then it kept going on. It went on for about like 7 or 8 people, and because of the Neo-Futurists, part of the whole show is a game in that we're trying to finish all 30 plays in 60 minutes. There came a point where, like, somebody eventually has to decide, okay, fine, I'm going to take it. And in a way, that person kind of wins. It's like an economy of social acceptance. Because a person at a certain point, once somebody stands up and says, do it, and they get soaked down, everybody applauds them. Like, everybody, like, cheered for that person because they helped out. They made us get the show moving. I always thought that was one of the more fun games in the whole world. Because if the first person does it, you just feel like, oh, that seems mean. Like, it seems like that would fail if the first person just accepted it. Or if it goes on for 30 people, then everyone's miserable because the show is boring. So it's really interesting to find that, working with the audience, to find, like, the really sweet spot in the middle of that.
Yeah, I think that actually leads to the last thing I would say about what a game is, which is a game should be playful in
mm-hmm.
some way. Like, the legal system is a set of rules in which there's a failure system, but it's not a game.
Because it's not very playful.
It's not playful. You know, like, the failure condition, I think, should be... The idea of a game is that if you lose, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think if you're setting yourself in a situation where you have to win, then that's not really a game.
Yeah.
A game, there should be the possibility of failure, and that should be okay.
Yeah.
And if there are consequences for failure, those should be self-imposed as part of the game. Like, yeah. Part of your art can be like, here's how I'm going to be punished if I fail at this, but that's still kind of playful.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, like, I think in podcasting, the idea of making a game, it can be broad and sweeping. Like, in some ways, Drew's podcast, Sleep With Me, is a game, right? The goal is to make something that gets you to sleep. It's just every episode is seeking to achieve that goal. And he, after however many hundred of episodes, like, he gets better and better at it. And so the game becomes easier. And so maybe it feels like less of a game because he's so good at it. In Welcome to Night Vale, you wrote an episode called All Right, which is sort of a game too, to play with the idea of, like, whether the audience will go along with taking their left earbud out and only listen through their right earbud and take in the sounds and the senses around them from their left side. Yeah, I like that as a game. Like, there's a level of interactivity that happens too.
Yeah. So now that we've kind of defined a game, at least in terms of how we're talking about it,
mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the different ways that they can be of value. And the first I want to talk about is the value of games in terms of inspiration, because a game, as we had said, is made of rules.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially, a game is at its heart a set of rules. And the nice thing about rules is they can force us to think outside of our usual routines, because if your brain tends to go a certain direction and you give yourself a rule that doesn't allow you to go that direction, it can take you to all sorts of new ideas that you just would have never come across if you hadn't played that game with yourself.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a little bit more about, like, limitations on yourself, right? Like, creating a structure around which to sort of, like, limit your imagination. And kind of helps funnel you in a certain direction so you don't have a tyranny of choice. And so, like, finding a set of rules for yourself can help. Yeah, it's like the garden hose thing. Like, it's a lot easier to run your water through a garden hose to water your garden than it is just to have a pond. Like, you know, it just doesn't, you need something through which it narrows and focuses and makes it shoot out in one specific direction.
I mean, I guess that's another good point, is a game is ultimately a fun limitation.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's a limitation you are giving yourself that makes things better for you. I mean, like, the most obvious type of game for this kind of thing, a game of inspiration, is the whole is randomization, obviously. Like, mm-hmm. The looking up a random Wikipedia article, for instance, is a classic way of getting a random subject. Using a random number generator, I've talked about a lot, is something I use all the time. You know, I did for Welcome to Night Vale, I did a story of love and horror, mm-hmm. which was a three-part story built around these characters, but the characters were chosen entirely by randomization. I had a long list of characters, used a random number generator to pick four of them, and said, okay, I need to write a story that equally talks about all four of these characters. That's a game.
Yeah.
You know, it's a limitation that forced me, because they were not necessarily characters I had thought about in a long time. So it forced me out of, like, I'm going to write another thing about one of our main characters that we talk about a lot, and forced me into, I'm going to try to find what's been going on with these characters I just haven't thought about for years.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah, because you end up having the owner of the antiques mall, the high school football coach, and you have the cartoon mascot, Barks Ennui. Who is, what is he the mascot for again?
The Sheriff's Secret Police.
That's right, he's the Sheriff's Secret Police mascot. Yeah, so you end up, yeah, having to, like, find a way to tie all those in together. And, yeah, it's an interesting point, too, because that forces you out of your normal rhythm of saying, like, well, what's Cecil up to? What does he think about this town? And that's sort of the normal pace for Night Vale. Yeah, I think about that a lot, too, of, like, I will sometimes when writing, I use the Wikipedia random generator trick. And so sometimes you get a location, and sometimes you get a historical event, and sometimes you just get a word. And it's sort of fun to think about, like, maybe you get the word, I got the word obstreperous one time, and I was like, obstreperous is a great word. And I think it fell into, I remember the faceless old woman saying it, and I can't remember if it's in one of the monologues.
I have a fairly good memory of you using that word just because I was I think I had to look it up. I just was like, what is that word?
It's so good. It's such a good word. I was like, this sounds great. This seems like a word the faceless old woman might use. And so sometimes you find those sorts of things. Those are so minor, like they're not necessarily audience interactive, but they're a challenge to use it. The 50 cent word definitely stands out if you're just using it in casual conversations. So you have to find a way to seamlessly meld it in.
Yeah. Let's move to the next value of a game. Which is still on the artistic on the artist side. So these are games that, you know, someone listening to A Story of Love and Horror would have no idea unless they were told that it was built around a game.
Yeah.
Some games are just for the artist, and this is another one which is in terms of structure. I mean, rules are a structure in a lot of ways. They give us a map, and it allows us to put a really wide variety of ideas into the narrow structure that the game has given us, and that gives them a logic and a reason to coexist.
Right.
You know, a classic example is limiting the letters or words you can use. You know, I'm going to write a poem that only uses a certain vowel.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to only use this sound. Or I'm going to start every line with this set of words, or I'm going, you know, an acrostic,
yeah,
where you start every line with a letter that spells out a thing. That's a classic. These are all ones that kind of, they give you a structure to work off of.
I loved what Ross Sutherland said, the from Imaginary Advice. He was on Helen Zaltzman's podcast, The Illusionist, and he talked about, and I always forget the name of that style of poem where you're only allowed to use one vowel, and he said, you know, by making that poem, what's really great about making that style of poem using only one vowel is that it changes your relationship to that vowel. You really do see the personality each of the five vowels has when you're only using O's or A's, I's or E's. Use. Nobody uses use. So the I think that's a really wonderful way in which it sort of bends your mind. It sort of shapes what you're going to do, and I think it creates something really beautiful for the audience too. Because one of my favorite things as an audience member is once I realize there are rules in place, once I see them sort of unfold, I think that's really wonderful. In some ways, a sonnet is a game. A limerick is a game. Like a highly structured poem is almost always a game. And so it becomes really clever to see ways in which people have to fit that in there and acknowledge those walls.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the values of having these structural games is, you know, you're an artist. You hate the establishment and structure, but so you're going to end up pushing against those, mm-hmm. but it's the fact that you push against them but still follow them that makes it interesting. It's a tension there.
Yeah.
You have to struggle a bit to follow the rules of the game, and it is my personal philosophy that the most interesting art often comes from someone trying to do something so difficult that they can just barely do it. Watching somebody struggle to do something difficult that is almost impossible for them, but that they can just barely do and they just barely do it, is the most gripping thing you can ever see in art.
Right. David Blaine.
We're talking
about David. This is our David Blaine fan cast.
You know, high notes in singing. Mm-hmm. When a really good singer hits a note that is just barely at the edge of their range and they really hit, that is so gripping for us because it's this thing of like, we know this person has an amazing voice, but we're really seeing them push themselves and be like, what is the limit of what I can take that to?
Yeah. Yeah, the virtuosic achievement. I think you and I saw a couple shows at the Edinburgh Fringe this year of like acrobatic feats that are, you know, it's super nerve-wracking. You see what they're building to. You see them building a whole structure to climb on top of, and then you know that they're going to end up doing some balance on like five chairs and then do a single hand handstand at the top of it. And you're just like, please don't fall, please don't fall. And like, there is a level of interaction there. Like they spell out exactly what they're about to do and then they do it. And that's a phenomenal achievement.
Yeah. And acrobatics is a good example of having failure built into the game is really important. Acrobatics is a game. And I think maybe this, cause it's Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So there's a ton of shows and everyone's a little tired, but like any acrobatic show you see, they're gonna miss occasionally and have to try again. And that's when it really gets exciting, right? Like watching someone miss and then start over and be like, I'm going to try that trick again.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you really, cause you then before then it looked so easy.
Yeah.
But that is the moment where you realize just how difficult what you're watching is. And now when maybe it takes them three tries, but on that third try when they do it, holy shit, that's when it really feels so much more incredible than the trick they did perfectly.
Yeah.
Because that was the trick that you got a sense of just how hard this trick is.
Yeah. I think in podcasting, like there's a, in some ways, well, not in some ways, like it is like improv is a game. And almost every aspect of theatrical improvisation is a game. And so like something like Hello from the Magic Tavern, you do get a sense of the rules of the game when they have a guest on. And you have to twist and play it for comedy. You know, there are moments when a guest may not know the rule of the universe that they've built over 100 and however many episodes. But it becomes humorous as they, you know, as they work within the rules. Or somebody may just establish a rule. Like, they may just suddenly say something, and you're like, well, that's canon now. We've got to work around that. And we do that in Night Vale, too. It's just much more long form because it's fully scripted. And so we will find that, like, oh, we've set a rule for ourselves. I guess we're going to have to address this now.
Yeah, I mean, we set really early on that writing utensils are illegal.
Uh-huh.
And it's really difficult when you're writing, when you're 140 episodes in plus two novels. Occasionally, you need your characters to write something down mm-hmm. that just comes up. And so we've had to develop this whole story that there's, you know, it's sort of like pot. It's like technically illegal, but decriminalized for a lot of people. Like, you know, if you're a wealthy white person, they're probably not going to search your house for pens.
Right.
So yeah, we've had to develop this kind of entire underground economy of illegal writing utensils in Night Vale just because we set that rule really early on and oops,
there it is. Yep. This funny joke now became a rule that we follow, which is sort of fun to kind of figure out. It's a little tougher in a novel when you're trying to have an economy of plot and narrative direction, and you're like, I don't need to bog down and explain this right now.
Yeah, I mean, that gets into the third... We're only kind of in the intro here.
Yeah,
so let's go a little faster on this. The third one I want to talk to is the value of games in terms of structure for the audience. If you tell the audience the rules or make it apparent to the audience, then we know where we're going, and we know what the stakes are. We see the skeleton, and that allows you to take the art in all sorts of directions that maybe the audience would feel unsure about, or, you know, an audience might be like, I don't know where you're going with this. But if you're like, this is the rules of the game, then they'll go with you kind of anywhere as long as you're still following those rules.
Right.
It has this built-in excitement and fun and tension for the audience when you're playing a game and they know the rules.
Yeah. Would you say that The Worst Idea of All Time fits into this discussion a little bit?
Oh, it absolutely does. That's a game. They've set themselves a task with a set of rules. You know, they're going to watch the same terrible movie once a week for a year and talk about it. And so that, I mean, think about as an audience member, if all you were encountering was the first episode and all you knew is, these two guys have watched a terrible Adam Sandler movie, and now they're going to talk about it for half an hour. I don't know about you. I wouldn't be interested in that.
Yeah.
I'd be like, cool, I get it. An Adam Sandler movie is bad.
Yeah.
But when it becomes, this is the first of 52 times we're going to watch this, and there's that tension built in of the two of them realizing what they've gotten themselves into.
And the shining light. Like, every episode, they have to, like, focus on something that really stood out positive for them to keep it from becoming two comedians just dunking on a bad movie.
Yeah. They build in all of these ways that make it, in my opinion, far more interesting than most let's make fun of this bad movie shows, because there is a game to it. And so there is a tension there.
Yeah.
You know, we are watching them struggle.
Yeah. And their real lives go on. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it affects their real lives.
Yes.
So let's jump, let's go through some examples of games that are just for the writer. We kind of already did some of these, but I just kind of wanted to put them in one place.
Mm-hmm.
So some example of games that are just for the writer is one we didn't talk about is word count and structural games.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I have done in the past and that we're actually doing on a thing we're working right now is I enjoy putting mathematical, and this might be because my mother is a mathematician, but I enjoy putting mathematical progressions into word length. So, for example, a long time ago for the book, the Commonplace Book of the Weird that I put together, I wrote a short story that was separated into chapters. And I think I'm trying to remember, I put a mathematical progression into them that they progressively got shorter as it went on. I think there was three sections to that, I want to say. In each section, the chapters were half the length of the section before. Right. And I really enjoy stuff like that. We're working on something right now where we have a similar thing where it's separated into parts, and we have set the word count for chapters and parts by this mathematical progression of getting short. In this case, it's actually getting longer and longer.
Yeah.
But it's this really fun way of just setting the structure of, like, this first part of the story I have to tell in these, like, very short bursts, these little vignettes. Whereas by the end, I have just this expanse to wander in. And it's, so it really gives you something to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's you discover as you write in that way, like in particular, like writing in a style that where chapters begin very, very short and then grow to extremely long, like start at a few hundred words each to several thousand words in a chapter, that you realize, like, as you go back and as I've gone back and kind of reread things, you realize, like, oh, the pacing of this is really fantastic. Like, it really changes exactly how you're reading it and what your expectation of the next sentence is. Because as the chapters become longer, there are moments that make you feel like, oh, I can sort of like sit with this character for a little while longer, as opposed to earlier chapters where I feel like, oh, there's a plot happening that I'm driving
through. You just got to establish a thing and then get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also length can be used, I think, to subconsciously for the audience signal what's important.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing I like to do in my work, for instance, we did this in the first Welcome to Nightvale novel. To me, I really enjoy having an important plot point be the longest chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So in Welcome to Nightvale, the novel, when we had them finally get to King City, the city they had been trying to get to the entire book, that chapter was, I think, three times as long as any other chapter in there. There's a similar, some of that was structurally based on the novel Night Film, which is a novel I really like. In that one, there's a similar thing where they're trying to get into this mysterious filmmaker's upstate compound. And when they finally do, the chapter where they do is something like 100 pages long, whereas before then it's been typical novel chapters of maybe 10 pages each.
Right.
So there is this thing of the length. Playing with word length can signal to the audience, okay, we are in a really pivotal moment, and that's why we're going to hang here for a while.
Yeah.
We had already talked, another game that's just for the writer is avoiding certain words or letters. It doesn't have to be just for the writer, obviously. Like writing a poem with just one vowel is a very showy thing that most people will notice.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily. You can also, you know, a rule can be for yourself. You can be like, I'm going to do this entire novel and not give anyone a name.
Yes.
And that's a game you're giving yourself.
Yeah.
Another one is time limits.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about this in other episodes. I want to do conversations on both speed and slowness.
Mm-hmm.
But setting a limit of either I'm going to do this very quickly, both the writing and the performance of it, I'm just going to get it done. Or it also is valuable sometimes to be like, I'm going to do this very slowly. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be like, this is a project where I'm going to write one sentence a day for years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something very good about that, and that's a game for you. You know, ultimately, while maybe they can tell the one that was made in 15 minutes versus the one that was made in 15 years, ultimately that has less to do with how it was made.
Yeah.
And finally, we talked about the randomization and outsourcing of inspiration.
Yeah,
you know, using random Wikipedia things or random number generators to tell you what to write about.
Yeah, to limiting your mindset so that you're not overwhelmed by all of the choices you have and you can target on one specific task.
Yeah, ultimately, the games that are just for the writer are all games that should be useful to you. They should yes. help you make the thing.
Right.
Then there are games that are for the audience. And those can be literal games. I mean, an obvious example is The Adventure Zone, which is a family telling a story by playing Dungeons & Dragons together. It is a famous game that has set rules that they kind of follow, but
right.
the point is, as a listener, you know, it gives us something to hold on to. If you tell someone, hey, it's a podcast in which a family tells a very long story about this other world, and sometimes it's a murder mystery on a train, and sometimes it's a car chase, that might be a little hard for you to get your head around. You're like, I'm not sure I can dive into this because I don't really understand what this is.
Yeah.
But when you tell them it's a family playing Dungeons and Dragons and kind of building this huge story around that, then that gives you an in.
Yeah.
You're like, I get it. It's this game. I understand that.
I think the huge success of all of the D&D podcasts has to do with, one, it's the popularity of Dungeons and Dragons, but I think more than anything, it's the idea that we can get a story, but it's processed in a way that we fully understand what's happening. Because the moment that people have to stop and roll for intuition or roll for an attack or whatever, that clues us in as to what's happening. And some of the fun of that is you break the character and you have the disappointment of the roller when they roll a two as they're being, you know, having a sword swung at them.
Yeah, I mean, it gives some tension to it.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, in theory, if they roll badly, that should change the story.
Yeah.
Which is why I think, like, people kind of got annoyed when they admitted that they sometimes fake dice rolls to make the story go in the way they wanted, because that's, to the audience, breaking the rules of the game. And
yeah.
Like that, I think that is a thing of, like, if you set the audience a game, they're going to want you to follow that game.
Yeah.
And they're going to get annoyed if you don't.
Yeah.
You know, no one likes a cheater.
No.
And they'll be able to tell. You know, and it doesn't have to be an established game. Any set of rules that an audience follows. You know, you had brought up earlier the Neo-Futurist and the Infinite Wrench, which is 30 plays done in 60 minutes to a timer. If the timer runs out before those 30 plays are done, it's done. And there's all sorts of other rules. You know, they set rules for themselves for the writing of it, that they can't pretend things. If they do something, they have to actually do it. If they talk about themselves, it has to be the truth, or it has to be about them lying. Like, they can't play a character.
Yeah.
And all of those rules are set out in the introduction to the show to the audience. They say, here is the game we're playing. And so even though watching the Infinite Wrench, sometimes you're watching an abstract dance piece, and sometimes you're watching someone talk about the death of someone they love, and sometimes you're watching a skit about how annoying it is to ride the subways in New York, all of those things have this built-in tension and cohesiveness because they are all following the rules of this game we understand.
Right. And the audience then becomes so aware of that, and they want the show to succeed. But they also, they don't want it to fail, but they understand that if it does fail, that's part of the joy of the show.
Like, yeah.
It's disappointing when you're halfway into a really funny, really great monologue or a really great dance piece or something in the Infinite Wrench, and that buzzer goes off and they just stop. You're like, oh man, I was really enjoying this play while the one before it was kind of garbage, and I really liked this one, and now it's done and we have to go home. It does feel very rewarding to have experienced that they were honest. They held to their word.
Yeah.
Show's done. See you later.
You know, I think if they were like, we have this half of a play left, let's just go another 2 minutes.
Yeah.
That would be annoying to the audience, even if they liked what they were seeing.
Yeah.
Because no, you set this game.
Yeah.
And you have to, once you set it, I guess that's something I would say to learn from that is once you set a game for an audience, you got to follow that.
Yeah.
Like, they get annoyed if you don't.
We saw the show in at Fringe, the poet / comedian Sean Mahoney did a show where he talked about his life as a boxer. And he brought a boxing timer and put it up over the stage. And a boxing clock is a 4 minute clock. It's 3 minutes of fighting and 1 minute of corner. And so there's two bells. One goes off at three, and then one goes off at four, and then it starts over. And it was interesting the way he told his story, because he told it in 10 rounds of 3 minutes each, following a 1 minute interstitial that usually was like a flashback of sorts. You know, he sort of bled, but we sort of determined that his rule for himself was when the buzzer goes off on the clock, just finish your sentence and then go to the next thing. And you could see a couple moments in that show where he had mistimed something and he had just had to stop talking and he didn't get to finish what he was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, because he established that thing early on of like, I'm not going to cut off mid-sentence, I will finish my thought. And so that didn't feel like cheating.
Right.
Like, great, you're going to finish that thought because that is the rules that you've clearly set. Which leads me to the next thing, which is rules that we aren't told, but that we pick up as we go. I don't believe he explained, this is what I'm doing.
No.
But when we have that timer very visible, and also the style of 3 minutes of kind of frenetic present tense storytelling followed by a minute of this kind of quieter flashback, we get, okay, 3 minutes of fighting, 1 minute of rest.
Yeah.
It's structured around that. Another example I can think of is the playwright Will Eno wrote a play called The Open House, in which he played a game of, it started with a cast of characters played by these actors, and then one by one, a character would leave, and then that actor would come back as a different character. And this kept happening one by one until finally there was only one of the original cast or one of the original characters left, and all of the actors were playing other characters. And there was definitely like a sense of confusion from that person of like, all of my other characters have been replaced by the same people playing other things. So it became this game of, we get it. And so then it became this big thing of like, when is that last person finally going to be replaced? And it was like the very last line of the play is when finally that person comes out as a new character and says their one line and it ends. Because that was a game that we slowly pick up. You know, it took a while. You know, because the first time it happens, okay, they've double cast. You know, that happens a lot in shows of actors playing different characters. But as it gradually happened and you started to understand that each time they were going to leave and come back as a different character, and then only after that would the next person leave and come. Yeah. Like, you start, that's a game that you pick up as you watch it.
Yeah. You had also pointed out in his play Middletown, there's a, it's a slight spoiler for the play, but there's a moment where you have somebody who's dying or is in the hospital, is sick, but the character keeps talking about building this garden. They're going to set up this garden, this community garden.
And once they're well.
Once they're well. And the way it was staged was that they didn't have, there weren't aprons. There weren't, you know, you can see all of the prop pieces backstage and side stage. And sitting side stage in full view of the audience is a whole prop set piece for a community garden. It's all sitting over side stage waiting to be brought out, and then it never gets used. And that's an amazing game that you don't realize till after the show is over, that this is there to play with the audience. It's set there to create expectations. It's a toy in which, how can I change what audience perception is or audience expectation is versus what I actually do?
Yeah, because they had all of the sets they were going to use just stacked up in view of the audience, and they had this community garden for this person who was very sick, but who was going to build that garden after they got well. And I think that's a good example of, that is him breaking the rules of the game, right? Because the rules he set is, you're going to see all the sets just out, and we'll use them when we use them. And
it's more of a card trick, right? Right? Than a card game.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a good example of, I mean, everything has exceptions, right? You totally can break the rules of your game.
Yeah.
But you have to know what effect you want to do.
Yeah.
Like, that was him breaking the rules of the game that he had set for himself, but in a way that was designed to shock us. Like, we were designed to, when that character, spoiler, dies, to have this moment of like, but wait a second, we knew he was going to live because his community garden was waiting right on those wings.
Yeah.
And so the shock of the betrayal of the game's rules being broken becomes part of our experience of losing that character.
It does get to one thing about this is this does get to the thing of like, when the rules get exposed to the audience, when you know they're going to pick up on them. This may not be a game, but I've always thought of the example. There's a play called The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde, Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde. It's a very long play, and I remember being in the show, and one of the things is, because the title says The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde, I was hitting about the 2-hour mark, and I'm like, we've only started the second trial. And I remember thinking, like, one of the things is that, like, you're letting the audience know there are three of these. And so you are setting up audience expectations once you know the rules. And that's a very simple example, maybe not truly a game. But once you set that out, once people realize that each character has to, or each actor has to leave and come back as a new character, then I'm, as an audience member, I'm...
Well, that's sort of the beauty of a game, is it, the beauty of any kind of structure. And as we said, a game is in many ways just a playful form of structure.
Yeah.
Is it tells the audience where they are. And an audience likes to know where they are. It helps your audience, and what helps your audience helps you. So an audience likes to know, oh, there were 10 characters, 7 of them have been replaced, so we're getting near the end. Like, I have an idea of where I am.
Yeah.
The Infinite Wrench literally has an hour timer going. And so that tells you, okay, I've got 15 minutes left of the show. I know that. So even though, say, the play I'm watching right now, I'm just not that into, like this particular 2 minutes, I'm fine, because listen, even if I hate all of the rest of them, I have 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, it just gives you a place where you know where you are.
Sit through anything for 15 minutes.
Sit through anything for 15 minutes. The last one I'm going to talk about is games of intentional failure. Games that are built to be lost, where the point of the game is losing. I think a really interesting example is the Disintegration Loops. So the Disintegration Loops were done by a musician and audio artist named William Basinski. They were done actually soon after September 11th. They were kind of his reaction to them. And what the Disintegration Loops are is, he found all these old tapes he had made of various compositions, orchestral compositions. and they were badly degraded. They had not been stored correctly, and they were just kind of falling apart. And so what he did is he took 2 to 6 second segments of that tape, put them and played them on a loop, recording that until they literally physically fell apart. And so what you end up with is these 32 hour and a half long loops that you can listen to of just this beautiful orchestral music gradually degrading and falling apart until there's nothing but a hiss. It's a game that's designed to lose. There's no way to keep that music. That music is designed to disappear. And it's so incredibly impactful. It's one of my favorite pieces of audio art ever made.
Yeah, the beauty of it is that it becomes something else entirely. It allows something that lived at some as something else to become an entirely different being, that it passes on. It has a child in some ways. I think that's a really amazing thing. So in some ways, it's structured to fail because he knows those tapes will break, but it's also succeeds in making something entirely new.
Yeah. Another example of this is at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2014. I saw a show called A Series of Increasingly Impossible Tasks, which, among other, I mean, it did a lot of incredible things, but one of the things they did as part of their show was a series of increasingly impossible tasks. Throughout the show, they would just try to do things that were absolutely impossible and then got more and more impossible. And of course, they couldn't do them. But that was the game. The game was they were supposed to fail because they were impossible tasks. And not just impossible, but increasingly impossible. and so there's a lot of impact you can get by setting yourself up for failure. And I think doing that can make you unafraid of failure, which is important.
Yeah.
If you're making art, the less afraid you are of failure, the better you are setting yourself up for success. We talked a bit about when to abandon games when we talked about Will Eno breaking the rules of his game. So that's one thing is you can do it in a way that creates an emotional impact where you suddenly end the game or you finish the game in a way that breaks the rules. And doing that can have a really interesting emotional impact that shocks the audience or makes them angry. Another one I can think of is a show called My Last Play that I absolutely loved. That was this playwright invited audiences 12 at a time into his living room in Brooklyn, just like his apartment living room. And it was a show that was this very personal monologue about his struggles to be a playwright and why he was finally giving up, why this was his last play. And he had a library of every theater book he had ever bought in his life, hundreds of them. And each audience, he gave away a book, one to each audience member. And he was going to do that until he had given away every theater book he owned. And then he was going to stop being a playwright forever. And it's this very affecting thing. And a lot of what he was talking about was he realized that theater couldn't help anyone because it wasn't real. Because ultimately, when his father died, even the best plays couldn't help him. And if it couldn't help him then what was the point? And he ended up illustrating this by breaking his own rules and revealing at the end that he was lying, that this wasn't his last play, that most of the monologue he had told us was made up. And it was such a betrayal that it completely illustrated his idea that the problem with theater is that it's fake. The problem was we had totally bought into the reality of this very touching experience. And all of it was manufactured. And so breaking his own rules and ending the game so abruptly was this way of shocking us into completely agreeing with his point.
Right. Yeah, I think in storytelling, one of the most common ways of breaking the rules of a game is the breaking of the fourth wall, is the epilogue or the insertion of the voice of the performer or the writer in some ways that tells you the truth about what's really going on. That can also be part of the game, too. It can also be the unreliable narrator of what is true at any point in time. In fiction, that's a really hard thing to determine. And once you set out to write a book, even if you say everything here is absolutely true, like, I don't know, but you're writing it, you're crafting it, this is your own experience. I think that's a very interesting thing, going back to the Will Eno Middletown situation of placing set pieces that build the audience expectation, because we've seen the game of this. In the Neo-Futurists, we, not often, but occasionally we'll write a play where in the middle of it, it says stop the clock. And one of the things about stopping the clock is that whatever happens when the clock stops, that's given like extra special attention. In theater all the time, you can bring the house lights up. You're breaking the expectations of what people think should happen in that moment. If you're sitting at a dinner with people and then you suddenly bang your fork on the side of your glass, that's a moment that draws special attention. That's breaking the rules of like conventional norm that says, now we have to break from our chit-chat and have a special announcement. And I think that's probably one of the more common ways in storytelling to do that.
Yeah, I mean, one that you taught me really early on in theater, because it was, I think, something you were very interested in and wrote a lot of stuff around, a really simple way of setting up an expectation and breaking it, breaking the game in a way that's effective, is if you are a person talking into a microphone, and then you take the microphone away and just shout at the audience without the microphone, there is this feeling of breaking the rules that you were, everyone understands a person talking at a normal volume into a microphone. And then when suddenly that same person, without having moved, with the everything in the situation being the same, steps a couple feet to the right of the microphone and just starts talking in a loud voice at the audience, there's kind of this shock. It feels emotionally different, an amplified and an unamplified voice.
Yeah. I love using bullhorns in theater because it elevates what you're doing, or it changes what you're doing. It changes the audience relationship to you entirely, because once your voice becomes not natural and fully processed, like really badly processed through a bullhorn, it changes what it, you know, what their relationship is to what you're saying.
So these are all when to abandon a game for the audience, that the audience is aware of. But also when we talk about games that are just for the writer, that are to kind of build something with, I would say abandon the games when they're not useful anymore.
Yeah.
I think a really good piece of advice, and I want to say I saw it best put by Hank Green in his... He gave a talk at the XOXO Festival in which he had the very, very memorable slide of fuck your dreams. but the point he was making is everyone has, say when they're like 15, they have a thing they really want to do. Like, oh, someday I'm going to do that. And you shouldn't feel obligated to that for the rest of your life. If you're now 35 and you no longer want to do that thing, it is not a betrayal of yourself to be like, I wanted to do that when I was 15. I don't want to do that now, so I'm not. And similarly with a game, while it is really useful, it can get you started to be like, I'm going to only use the letter O. Say you start to write a poem and you realize you're trying to say something with it and you can't. It's not a betrayal of yourself to leave the game you started with behind.
Yeah.
Once it's no longer useful, it is only for yourself.
Yeah.
And so it's totally okay to leave that game behind and move forward.
Yeah. Once you realize that, I use cooking analogies a lot when it comes to writing, but it really is like, sometimes you just know this pizza's burnt. Like you just know it's inedible at a point and you have to stop, but you know, you can learn something from it. And sometimes you just say, well, I don't know, let's see what happens if I combine salmon and blueberry, you know, let's see if this taste works. And then you might later be like, I'm going to complete the dish. I can already smell that it's not going to work, but I need to just know.
I want to end on two quick points that come back to the value of games. And one is that games help you be less precious about art. You know, art that has to be the fullest expression of yourself can put a lot of pressure on you. And it can, this idea of this has to stand the test of time, this has to fully express everything I'm trying to say. But a game takes that pressure off because you can't, because you have limitations. If you have to write a short story a day, because that's the game you set yours to yourself, then you can't worry too much about if each short story is going to still work as well in 100 years. Who cares? Because tomorrow you have to write another one. So games are a really useful way of taking the pressure off of art and making you less precious about it.
Yeah, I fully agree. It's completely about... I think so much of artistic creation is taking the romance about being a writer out of it, is that it's making it a job and focusing on the task at hand. And sometimes you have to find... emotional stimulation to get you motivated. You want to feel excited. You want to feel good. But a lot of it is just like, you know, we joked when we were starting this because we just kind of sat down in front of the mics and then immediately started the episode. And we're like, this is like going, like football players just like showing up and just immediately kicking the ball off and not stretching or whatever. But, you know, in some ways, like we've been the last few days, like sending these back and our notes back and forth to each other. And we spent a lot of time thinking about it. So, and we ended up, we did have probably several minutes that's not going to be used in this episode to sort of get ourselves warmed up. It's a job. You have to get yourself in a mental state to write. And sometimes that's eating well. Sometimes it's just getting a good night's sleep. Sometimes it's setting hours for yourself. And sometimes it is really, really, really focusing what your creative attention is going to be on, because that will help you get that task done.
Yeah. Thinking of getting yourself into the emotional standpoint, the other thing I wanted to highlight is games can be fun. And, you know, setting yourself up in a situation where it is fun to do your work is going to make you, if not do better work, I can't promise that, it'll make you do work. You know?
Yeah, that's it.
If you're looking for motivation to do a thing, setting yourself a game that seems fun or challenging or exciting at least gets you into the movement of it, you know? And that's, I think, a lot of the point of a game. Yeah. is by being fun, it serves as a stimulating and motivating factor.
That's a great way to start. I think that's a great thing to end on.
Sure.
The opposite of starting.
The opposite of starting. The name of my next novel, The Opposite of Starting. All right, we'll be back with our assignments, but in the meantime, listen to whatever is going to happen after I stop talking now. Hello, Joseph here. I have two books coming out this year. Seriously, May 11th, 2021. The first 10 years, two sides of the same love story. So there is a love story that happened behind the scenes of Welcome to Night Vale between me and Meg Bashwinner, MC and tour manager for the live Night Vale show. In this memoir, we recount the first 10 years of our relationship, year by year, without consulting each other beforehand. It's a funny and romantic story about how differently we experience and remember our lives. Then on July 20th, 2021, The Halloween Moon, my first ever novel for ages 10 and up. Esther Gold loves Halloween, until the year that Halloween night just won't end. Even she doesn't want Halloween to last forever. No matter your age, if you are a fan of what I do, I think you're going to love this book. Get these books wherever you get your books. And we're back. Let's get into our assignments. Jeffrey, what is our assignment to consume?
I want you to consume the podcast Imaginary Advice. I want you to consume episode 49. It is called Regarding the Moon, or Re: The Moon. It contains one of the most fun and useful writing games that we've heard in a long time. Ross Sutherland, who creates Imaginary Advice, is a poet, playwright, and just all around really amazing guy who has a lot of really creative, fun, different games throughout this whole show, really, that he does. But in The Moon, he talks about, as a poet, one of the most talked about things, the most played out topic of poetry has to be the moon. The moon or love, those have to be like the two most talked about things in poetry. So it becomes really difficult to write new things about the moon, and this whole episode becomes how do we talk about the moon in a new way. And he has a really great game that we'll actually use here for you to do, and we'll talk about that in a second. But it's very funny and it's really fascinating, and the stuff that he comes up with to describe the moon is hilarious and then sometimes just truly mind-bending to actually try to process. Another really great episode, if you want to go ahead and subscribe to Imaginary Advice, is the one that follows at episode 50, is 4 or 5 Weddings and 1 or 2 Funerals, which is a classic exquisite corpse game between he and a friend, but they're playing off of the movie 4 Weddings and a Funeral, and instead of building a story themselves, they're actually battling against each other. They flip a coin and one has to write the story toward wedding, toward love, and the other has to write the story toward a funeral or death. And it becomes the whole exquisite corpse game. You become very aware of the rules happening because they both have to yes and. You can't just negate what your partner says, but you also have to steer the story in a totally different but still rational direction. So that's your consume assignment.
Yeah, that whole podcast is just full of so many really interesting writing games. Almost every episode is built around some sort of interesting game.
Unsubscribe to this and go subscribe to... I'm just kidding.
So for our create, as Jeffrey said, we're going to be using Ross Sutherland's game from episode 49 of his podcast. I want you to listen to his explanation of it. I'm going to briefly talk about it here, but I think it's important to listen through the reasoning and thought process behind the game, because I think it's an important part of what we're doing here. But just to say briefly, we're going to be using the rules he sets to create 3 statements about the moon, taking the form of the moon is a adjective and a noun. And as the rules are in Imaginary Advice, that adjective and noun cannot come from you. You can't try to describe the moon. You have to, say, flip around in a book and just grab the first adjective and noun you see, watch a TV show and the first adjective and noun, or just Google random adjective generator and random noun generator. They exist. They're very useful. So you're going to build three statements, three different statements. The moon is a random adjective, random noun. And then you're going to use those three statements to each be the first sentence of three paragraphs. And the goal you have in these paragraphs is to take that moon statement as though it were intentional, as though it were not random, but that you meant to describe the moon as a faulty shopping cart, say.
As a bucolic bicycle.
Exactly. And build on that and tell a story with it. So we are having three paragraphs, each one starting with a moon statement, and building on that image to tell a story. Take that image seriously and really try and find the logic in it. Be like, what does this image mean and how can I build it into a story that makes sense? This could be a nonfiction personal narrative. It could be fiction. Whatever you want to do with it, as long as you take those moon statements as set rules that you have to then build on. If you want a second layer of game and an added layer of difficulty, there is no pressure on this.
Cut off one of your fingers.
Cut off one of your fingers first. Or, alternately, consider making the first paragraph about the past, the second paragraph about the present, and the third paragraph about the future. It just gives you another way of limiting your thoughts and building to a very specific story.
That's all for this episode, but your assignment is just beginning. Head on over to startwiththispodcast.com to join our membership community. Becoming a member allows you to share your assignments with other listeners, talk about what's sparking your creativity, and hopefully find future collaborators. Plus, you'll be able to ask follow-up questions about this and future episodes, and gain exclusive access to episodes where we answer those questions. Membership is just $5. That's basically a piece of paper with Abraham Lincoln on it. That's all it takes to be part of our membership forum. We can't wait to see what you're working on. Start With This is a production of Night Vale Presents. It's produced by Julia Melfi. Editing by Grant Stewart. Mixing by Vincent Cascione. Theme by Joseph Fink. All other music is by Caged Animals. Find more at cagedanimals.net. Very special thanks to Adam Cecil and Christy Gressman. Check out nightvalepresents.com for more information about this show and all of our other shows. And thanks for listening.
So I think that is it for our show. Let's end as we usually do. I haven't thought of one of these. As is often said by people playing games.
Mm-hmm.
The most dangerous game
is Monopoly
in front of a car.
Bears.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Craner, and I wanted to tell you about one of my other podcasts, Random Number Generator Horror Podcast Number 9. So the thing is, my friend Cecil Baldwin, the voice of Night Vale, loves horror movies, and he's helping make the genre more approachable for me, and hopefully for you too, one film at a time in a random order. Are you squeamish about horror movies? Look, I get it, and no worries. Just listen in and we'll tell you everything that happens. But do you love horror movies? Well, that's great too. Watch along with us each week. We've got nearly 200 episodes covering everything from The Shining to Leprechaun 4 in Space. I'm serious, we go in a random order. So check out Random Horror 9 wherever you get podcasts.